Hello once again, and welcome to Turkey Book Talk. I'm the host, William Armstrong. In this podcast, I talk to authors about newly released books on Turkey and its region, which I've reviewed in the Hurriyet Daily News. You can subscribe to Turkey Book Talk on iTunes, Podbean, or Stitcher, or you can follow via the Facebook page or my website, armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com. In that way, you can make sure that you don't miss an episode. And if you're a fan of the podcast, you can also support it via my Patreon account, making a small monetary donation, or a large one, on a per episode basis. Find details on all the Turkey Book Talk pages or on my website. But now let's get cracking with the show. And in this episode, I speak to Cem Emrence, who's the author of a new book called Remapping the Ottoman Middle East, Modernity, Imperial Bureaucracy, and Islam, which is published by IB Taurus. The book gives us an original take on the Ottoman Empire's modernization process through the 19th and early 20th centuries. Cem Emrence describes a model of three trajectories in the coast, the interior, and the frontier, which all followed distinct paths to modernity. I started by asking him to give a basic overview of this three trajectory model.
Well, in the book, I mainly suggest that the Ottoman Middle East was characterized by three regional trajectories: coast, interior, and the frontier. These trajectories emerged simply because they represented distinct routes to state centralization on one side and economic integration on the other. So as a result, you got the coastal trajectory, which primarily included Western Anatolia and the Eastern Mediterranean littoral. And these regions were characterized by global economic flows, and they were under the leadership of non-Muslim middle classes. In the interior, which included Anatolia, Syria, and Palestine, it was a different story. Ottoman state-building efforts were at the center of these regions' transformations, and a Sunni Muslim bloc held the leadership position. In the frontiers, Iraq, Arabian Peninsula, and Eastern Anatolia, geopolitical competition played a central role. Rural religious leaderships were instrumental in terms of organizing public life. And basically, these regions evolved around the idea of local autonomy. The key idea, though, I think mention here is these were not simply geographical regions. Instead, they were socioeconomic orders. In other words, what I call them historical trajectories. So they were the making of local actors on one side and structural forces on the other. They started at some point and ended at some point. They were interactive and uneven formations.
Now, this model is really original in Turkish historiography. How is it original, and how does this three trajectory model differ from previous historiographical approaches?
I think it's a great question, and I think a lot of people picked up on this part of the book. Maybe I should, in a couple of minutes, mention how the field of Ottoman and Turkish studies and historiography evolved over time. Very simply, there were three different ways of looking at this. Number one, there were what I call the monocausal accounts. The idea was here to understand late Ottoman history in terms of westernization, capitalism, or state building. But in fact, as anyone can imagine, all the three forces played their role in Ottoman history at the same time. So none of these models included the contribution, the constitutive role of these three forces at the same time. The other approach was state-centric analysis, which I believe are more popular in popular imagination as well. The idea here is that the Ottoman state or great powers or the nation states were central in understanding late Ottoman history. But these accounts were primarily about intent or vision or perspectives of state leaders rather than the application of certain policies. So they were not talking about what was happening on the ground. They were mostly about what the state leaders thought, envisioned, or tried to do to accomplish. And number three, there were also the center-periphery models, which I think were the most influential. And these were primarily, these accounts were primarily about binary, what I call binary outcomes. In other words, depending on the policies of the state, local actors either cooperated with the central state or engaged in a conflictual relationship. So there's either one or zero type of approach. So what I brought to the table, or what I tried to bring to the table, was to come up with an account that addresses intra-empire differences. In other words, how did the Ottoman Empire evolve differently, different regions evolve differently, primarily throughout the 19th century? So the idea was to explain variation within the Ottoman world by taking into account multiple causes on one side and multiple outcomes on the other. So there were different forces that allowed the Ottomans to evolve differently, and there were different outcomes, not only one or two. So at the end, I ended up having this comparative interactive account, which included different regions evolving in relation to one another, and it gives us an opportunity to understand differences within the Middle East and how the modern Middle East evolved differently because of these critical interventions at this critical moment.
So effectively, rather than having a single homogeneous explanatory theory or vision of modernization and change, your approach tries to include the sheer variety of socio-economic conditions in the late Ottoman Empire.
Exactly. I mean, we have to account, and take into account, in fact, the fact that capitalism played a role. Ottoman state building played a role. The geopolitical competition of great powers and regional forces played a role. But there should be, what I tried to come up with was a framework that accounted all these forces, which resulted in different trajectories. So, for instance, in the frontiers, it wasn't the capitalism world economy, but rather great power intervention and the competition between these forces that very much influenced historical outcomes. But on the coast, it was the world economy. In Syria, for instance, the story is about neither of these forces, but rather it's about Ottoman state building. So in other words, I try to come up with this multi-causal account, which sort of included all these forces and at the same time explain why we ended up in different types of societies across the region.
Now, do you think that this model is applicable in a longer term as well? And here I'm particularly thinking of the Kurdish region, or the Kurdish majority region in today's Turkey, as a kind of frontier region.
I think this is a great question, and this is one of the, I think, things that the book tried to accomplish. In other words, trying to come up with a framework that has some kind of a more life to it. In other words, in terms of duration. Typically, in the Ottoman history field, original research has been done to come up with short-term accounts. In other words, there's some force that you identify that has a similar effect on a certain thing. The closest we have in what we can name long-term account is the long 19th century accounts in Ottoman history, which talks about the Ottoman state struggle with Europe on one side and the state's efforts to give its house an order, in other words, the modernization. But these accounts are primarily about state about state elites and their visions and what they try to accomplish. So they don't necessarily talk about people and vast regions of the empire. My framework, I think, works best, especially between 1950 and between 1850 and 1950. By the interwar period, all the three trajectories for structural forces and for other reasons come to an end. The Great Depression, the Cold War ends with the Great Depression because it very much creates closed economies. Colonialism ends the interior model. The frontier very much loses its meaning with the rise of the nation states and the Cold War. Although, having said that, I think the longest continuity that we observe is in the frontier. I think this is the place where there are really sinister forces at play. Couple of major obvious continuities are using rebellion or armed resistance as a claim-making strategy from Yemen to Eastern Anatolia to Iraq, but also this is the frontier parts of the frontier is the place where you still get security threats for nation states. But in the case of the Kurdish issue and Kurdish resistance, I think there are more interesting comparative lessons that we can draw. I think the most important point here for me is that it was in the 1890s, I think the region as a frontier, as a near frontier region, to be more compatible with the book's framework, is divided between religious and ethnic networks. In the 1890s, it was primarily between Islam and Armenian nationalism. Today, it was between Islam and Kurdish nationalism. So, as a result, the state survives, but with a serious legitimacy deficit. Why do we observe these two competing and rival networks? Partly, I think the reason the book also hints at that, and in my other work at Zones of Rebellion, I expand on this theme, is that the state try to use co-optation and transformation strategies together. So this, what I call in-betweenness, in other words, not really deciding or having the capabilities to go from one to another, in other words, from co-optation to transformation. This cyclical ideology, I think, results in a situation where the state is caught between a rock and hard place. The idea here is with co-optation, you have to either have friends, which means you'll have foes. If you have friends, you have foes, then you come up with policies and strategies that very much divide the region from time to time. So in that respect, I think the policies that the state implements, like special administrative regions, very much structures the region. And in that respect, it was that moment, I think it was in that moment during the 1890s, The policies that were decided at that moment, I think, very much shaped the region's history until now.
And you mentioned there your previous book, Zones of Rebellion, which we spoke about and which we did an interview about last year, I think. And I'm going to post a link to that interview on the website. But just following up from what you said there, I do think it's particularly interesting, actually, how in the frontier region during the 19th century, the Ottoman state turned to this moral religious agenda, emphasizing shared Sunni Islam to try to gain legitimacy in areas in these frontier regions where the grip of state institutions was weak. And that has obvious echoes today with the ruling AKP's strategy in Turkey's Kurdish majority areas, where it relies on this overarching Islamic identity between Turks and Kurds in the face of rebellion.
Yeah, certainly. That's what I also had in mind. I think typically the region's history always evolved between co-optation and transformation. Late Ottoman history, it's primarily co-optation. Interwar period comes the period of transformation. Then between 1950 and roughly 1970, for political reasons, because of multi-party politics, then intermediaries were co-opted once again. Then comes the period of transformation, which creates these ethnic entrepreneurs. So it was primarily transformation or schooling, for instance. They created the ethnic entrepreneurs for the first time in the region, high schools. And then once again, by 2000, the state and its and the government concludes, and I think because of its own political priorities, concludes that we have to go back to this co-optation agenda where religion plays a fundamental role. And just a basic survey, even looking at the region at the district level, I think, allows one to conclude that there is a concerted effort by the government to spread and to use sort of religious symbols and rituals to combat an ethnic movement at several levels.
And is there any reason to believe that this policy will be more successful today than it has been in the past?
This is a question probably I don't know the answer to, but so far, what we have seen, what we knew from late Ottoman history, and what we have seen in this episode is that both of them ended with war, unfortunately. So one side primarily defeats the other through war, through displacement, and using similar strategies. So I'm not sure if a cultural approach would be enough to defeat an ethnic movement. And I think we have all the reasons and all the evidence, especially with reference to recent counterinsurgency campaigns, that there are also other tools, I think, and instruments at play that the government is using.
Now, there's an idea that you describe in the book of how different post-Ottoman states each incorporated the three different historical trajectories within single countries, which is true in Turkey as well as elsewhere. And the implications may be quite big, perhaps explaining even the so-called legitimacy deficit that people talk about regarding states in the Middle East today. Could you just explain this and talk about what are the long-term effects of these different historical trajectories being incorporated within single states?
Obviously, one has to start with, I think, acknowledging the fact that empires and nation states, despite several continuities, are different things. But I think while I was writing the book, I noticed strong continuities, especially in the interwar period. And as time went by, I was intrigued by the more long-term consequences of these trajectories. One can wonder, what is this about trajectories making a difference? Simply put, different trajectories means different ways of organizing economy and politics and culture, and they represent different ways of doing things. So it was a story, it was a question about state formation. In other words, how do you organize the state? What are the priorities of the state? What kinds of policies these Middle Eastern states would use? And as I mentioned, strong continuities, I think, existed in the interwar period, where a struggle started automatically between political centers and different regions. So the reason I claim, at least, there were political struggles between political centers and different regions, these correspond to differences in terms of different trajectories. So in the Turkish case, there was strong political resistance from Izmir, as a lot of people would probably forget, that the largest political opposition in terms of mobilization in the Turkish context came from Western Anatolia. They didn't have arms, but they didn't have guns, but they simply went to the ballot box. This happened in 1930. And on the other side, there was armed opposition that came from Eastern Anatolia, which corresponded to near frontier. But there were similar forces at play in Syria, for instance, the rivalry between Damascus and Aleppo, and the situation with the Druze represented a similar moment. And in the Arabian Peninsula, the conflict was between Riyadh and the Hijazi region or Hijaz. At the end, by 1930s, I think political centers win the contest using force and other means. I think this kind of analysis, I think, begs the question, what would have happened, a counterfactual? What would have happened, for instance, if political centers either try to negotiate with these regions or came to some kind of agreement? Well, I think in the short run, there are a number of positives that really stand out. One is that there would be more debate about policy choices, about the economy, about culture, and about politics, and especially political culture, would change as a result. And number two, I think there would be more contribution to the decision-making process from the locals. So local participation would have increased. These are all good things. The more speculative, I think, reading would be what would have happened in the long, long run, which is obviously today. I think there are there would have been two options. On the one side, this kind of scenario leads to a situation where there is more power sharing. This is the good scenario. The bad scenario is that this would lead to a more fragmented and polarized society in each Middle Eastern state. So on the one side, you can end up as a place like Switzerland, where you have all this diversity and differences, but there's also a common ground where people agree, citizens agree on certain things, how we conduct certain things in public life, in politics, economy, and whatnot. On the other hand, you can end up being like Kosovo or even worse, Sudan and others, where this might lead to autonomy, this might lead to cessation, or this might even lead to identities, really rigid identities, where everyone is, as in the Lebanese case, where everyone sticks to his or her identity and the differences become unbridgeable. So in that respect, in the short run, in the interwar period, I think more lenience towards regions, I think, would have worked perfectly in the long run, unless the puzzle of what is the common ground that holds these societies together. Is it rule of law? Is it something else? Without solving this question, having differences and acknowledging differences does not automatically mean that we'll live happily ever after.
That was Cem Emrenci. You can find a link to my review of Remapping the Ottoman Middle East at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com, where there's also an edited transcript of this interview. As I mentioned during the conversation, I've also posted on the website a previous interview with Cem about his book on Turkey's conflict with the PKK, Zones of Rebellion. Remember, you can subscribe to Turkey Book Talk via iTunes, Podbean or Stitcher. If you like the podcast, please do rate it on iTunes or Stitcher, which helps other people find the show. Or you can like the Facebook page. And if you have some spare change, you can also support the podcast via my Patreon account, donating on a per episode basis. Many thanks to current supporters Andrew Cruikshank, Özlem Bey Arslan, and Steve Bryant. Find links to all that on the Turkey Book Talk pages. But until the next episode, again, thank you very much for listening.